over the weekend, starting tomorrow, we'll be doing a four-day teaching at the Muse Tucson Arts Center. And the subject I wanted to go over, this is sort of a, what do you call it? Tibetans say chakishak. Say chakishak. Chakishak. Chak means iron, Q means hook, and shak means to set it. And so this is a chakishak for those teachings. We're just going to talk a little bit about what's going to happen in those teachings. And it's a very, very beautiful subject. We're going to be going over a book. I'm just going to write the name to impress you. I always tell people that the first Dalai Lama said, always write some foreign languages when you give a teaching, and then people will think you know what you're talking about. He really did say that. So anyway, it's called Uttara Tantra. It's not coming up? There? Okay. And in Tibetan, that's the Gyu Lama. I like to ask people to repeat the words just because we think it's a good seed in your mind. Like you get some kind of Buddha seed put in your mind, and then like 12 lifetimes from now we meet again at the University of Kansas or something, and we study together or something. So say Gyu Lama. Gyu Lama. You know the word Lama. That's the word for a teacher in Tibetan, right? Any teacher, could be woman, man, could be ordained, not ordained. Anyone who teaches other people spiritual things is called a lama. And it means the higher part of something, the more advanced part of something, okay? So a lama is like a big guy or something like that. That's the word means. And then gyu, and that's the word uttara in Sanskrit. Gyu means tantra. Tantra can mean secret teachings, I think you know, in Tibet. But it's also a word for a series of things. It comes from a Sanskrit root tan, which came into English as tenuous or tendon or tendonitis, or meaning stretched out. And so tantra means like a stretched out series of teachings. So what we're going to cover over the weekend at the Muse is this book. And it's not a tantra in the sense of a secret teaching. That's a different kind of book. This is a tantra in the sense of the last part of a series, the higher part of a series. Series of what? This is a series of books that were written about 350 AD by somebody named Maitreya. Okay? And we believe that the next Buddha in this world, some people say he's not due for a few billion years. Some people say 500 years. So 490 years, something like that. Maitreya is the next Buddha supposedly due in this world. And this Buddha is supposed to be up in some paradise somewhere. And you can't see this Buddha unless you meditate for a long time. And then if you do very good meditations and if you have good training, that you could meet this person. So supposedly 16 centuries ago, Maitreya appeared to a very famous meditator named Asanga, and then took Asanga to his paradise and taught him this book called Uttara Tantra. So we'll be studying a book that was written about 16 centuries ago. And that book has been passed down through the years in India, and then it came into Tibet and it was studied in Tibet. The book is really famous because it teaches a thing called Tathagata Garbha. I'll impress you with another language. Now I'll give you some Sanskrit. Ready? Tathagata. You got to stretch out the second A. Ready? Tathagata. Garbha. Tathagata. Garbha. Yeah. Tata means that way. That way, like that. And the word that comes from it. Gata means gone. And the word gone and come both come from the same root, Tathagata. So they went that way. What way? You can say to enlightenment, okay? They went to enlightenment or bliss, okay? Sometimes they're called Deva Shekpa, which means went to bliss, Sugata Garba, okay? Sugata. Then Garba means a womb, like a mother's womb in which the baby is formed. And this is an idea about what we call Buddha nature. In Tibetan, it's called Rik. Say Rik.
Rik.
Rik. Rik. Roll the R like ruffles. Rik. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. Rik means the Buddha inside of you, and that was billed as the subject of the talk tonight, right? Rik means the Buddha inside of you, okay? So we're going to do an experiment, you know? Like Buddhism says you have a Buddha inside of you. Buddha says you have Buddha nature called Rik, or Sugatagarbha. The womb of the next Buddha is in you, whether you're a man or a woman, okay? And I want to do an experiment. First, we're going to do a 5-minute meditation, okay? So we'll turn this off. I'll get up here. Just sit up straight. You don't have to like cross your legs. I don't think it's possible in these chairs. Okay. Something below here. Okay. And I just want to lead you to a short meditation. We'll do a meditation. We're going to try to reach your Rik, okay? Your Buddha nature, all right? Just for fun, okay? And then I'm going to talk about Buddha nature, okay? Because it's a big argument, even in Tibet. In Tibet, there was a big argument. And we'll be talking more about that this weekend. But there was a huge debate, you know, what's the Buddha inside of you? What's your Buddha nature, okay? So try to stay real quiet. Remember, if you sniffle, it's not so much that you're going to be disturbed, but the person next to you will be disturbed, okay? So try to at least get your shoulders straight and your head straight. Your back as straight as you can. If it's as comfortable, I think, join these two, the first finger and thumb, okay? These are from the 9th century, somebody named Bhavanakrama of Kamanashila. He wrote a book about meditation, and we are trained that way in Tibetan monasteries. Then you put the back of your hands on your knees. Re-straighten yourself, okay? And then I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, and I'll close my eyes, and I'll meet you in a few minutes, okay? There's always a preparation for meditation, which is watching your breath. So just sit, watch your breath for about 5 minutes. Okay, I'll make it 3 minutes. But try to sit very still. Don't move. Watch the breath coming out of your nose. Very strictly. Don't go anywhere else. Keep your mind on your breath as it enters your nostrils. Okay, and we'll do that for a few minutes. That's just like to get warmed up. A beautiful red rose in your heart. So right inside of your heart, picture a red rose. There's a special instruction in the Tibetan monasteries. They say the smaller you can make it, the sharper it will be. So if you can make it the size of a marble, that's good. If you can make it the size of a pea, that's even better. But then see if you can make it as small as a grain of sand. A perfect little red rose, open red rose. Sitting on the rose is a Buddha. So picture a Buddha sitting in the middle of the rose, very soft, center of the rose. Again, if you can swing it, try to make it as tiny as a grain of sand. So the Buddha would be inside the grain of sand. It's that only that big, inside your heart. Now open your eyes. Question. You can move around a bit, okay? We're going to start that. We're going to go back to that meditation, okay? I don't know, the gentleman with the goatee. Sorry to embarrass you. Yeah. What did your Buddha look like? And what kind of form, like what color or?
Dark red.
Yeah?
Blood red.
Okay, good. And the lady behind him with the glasses. Yeah, sorry. I don't mean to embarrass you, but if I ask people to raise hands, only the very outgoing people will raise their hands. What did your Buddha look like?
Also gray.
Yeah? Wow, that's cool. And the young lady right behind her with the blonde hair. What? Say again? Good. Good. Male or female? Yeah, that's the first problem I have. Okay. We gotta talk about Buddha nature, okay? And Buddhas. You know, I was thinking about what do I say in Tucson, and I said, I don't know, because I don't know who's gonna show up, but one thing you gotta know about Buddhas is that they can be male or female, okay? I mean, I don't know about you, but when I first learned about Buddhism, there were all these pictures of a big guy with a big belly and a shaved head, and some of them have a bump on the head, and definitely their ears are too long. And I even had one fine student who's here tonight, and I won't embarrass them. We were walking through a Mongolian temple one day in New Jersey. And this person was standing next to me, and we stood before a painting of the historical Buddha, right? Who's this guy, sort of chubby and bald, and then has this bump. And then the person said, you know, Mike, I don't know if I want to get enlightened, you know? And I said, you know, why? And they said, they look so weird, you know? Like the ears. Their ears are like a foot long, you know? Like I don't know if I want to be like that, you know? And I think that's the first problem, you know? That's the first thing we have to talk about, Buddha nature, you know? Buddha nature means the seed in you or the future Buddha inside of you, right? So I think one big step to get over with Buddha nature is that thinking that they gotta be oriental. Is the first thing, right? Like, they gotta be oriental, right? They gotta look oriental. And then they gotta be, like, kind of chubby and have a bald head and all that. And I was in St. Petersburg. I was at the Hermitage Museum. And they took me to see the Buddhist statues. They had, like, 1,000 Tara statues, you know, in the warehouse. And then, frankly, because they... during Stalin's time, they burned all the monasteries in Eastern Russia and stole all the statues. But they have this huge warehouse of Buddhist statues, you know. And then they took me out into the museum, and there was a, what do you call the thing on the wall, the painting on the wall? Like a fresco, yeah. There was a fresco that they had stolen from the wall. They stole the whole wall. They took the wall off a temple in Dongguan, which is north of Tibet. It's on the Silk Road. And these people were Buddhist a long time before Buddhism reached Tibet. Like, long time before Buddhism ever got to Tibet, it reached this Central Asia, above Tibet, north of Tibet. And they took me to see the fresco, and there's this big, nice Caucasian guy on the fresco in silk robes. And I swear to God, he looked like Winston Churchill, you know? And he looked just like Winston Churchill. And I'm like, you know, and my I studied Russian in college, and it's not very good. So when I talk to them, I'm like, я не понимаю, что это, you know? And they said, this is Vajradhara. Это Vajradhara. And I'm like, нет, нет, что это image, you know? What's the image there? And they said, нет, нет, Vajradhara. And I said, they said it's like a tantric deity, Vajrasattva, Vajradhara. What do you call it? Vajrapani, like that, you know? And I'm like, no way. And they said, read it, you know, and читайте. And there's this little Sanskrit thing there, and it says Vajradhara, you know? And I said, so this is how this deity, this Buddha, was painted before Buddhism got to Tibet, right? And they said, yeah. I said, well, he looks just like my people that I grew up with and you guys, you know? And he said, yeah. And then it just dawned on me that every culture makes the Buddha look like their own culture, you know? So, I mean, Buddha probably looked like a Bengali, like Christ probably looked like a big rabbi, you know? And Buddha probably looked like a Bengali or something. But they've been painting him Chinese in China, and they paint him Nepali in Nepal, and they paint him as a Tibetan in Tibet. And this is how Buddha looks. And then people like you and me, we tend to think, oh, you know, if I get enlightened, I gotta look like that, you know? Like my friend in the temple in New Jersey, who's over this way somewhere. Like you tend to think, like, I'm gonna have to look like that. And I think that's the first problem. I mean, the deal about Buddha nature, right? The neat thing about Buddha nature, which is called the, I'm gonna throw some Tibetan out. Say Sangye.
Sangye.
Su.
Gyurung.
Sangyesu.
Gyurung.
Sangyesu Gyurung means anything that can turn into an enlightened being. Okay? Is the definition of Buddha nature. Tathagata Garbha is defined as Sangyesu Gyurung. It means, and we do this in the monastery for 6 hours every night, you know. If you've ever seen this debating, you know. And we say, yeah, Rikitani Shaki, maybe Eche. Tamadu, Rikitani Shaki, Blata. Shak! Yeah, Sangyesu Gyurung, Sangyesu Rikitani Yimbata. Yeah, but she got it right. Anyway, if they beat you, you just change the subject. They do those debates like 5-6 hours every night. And then you learn like that, you know. It's really good. But anyway, the definition of Buddha nature, Buddha womb inside of you, is just anything that can turn into a Buddha. So the parts of you that can turn into a Buddha, okay? The parts of you that can turn into a Buddha is the definition of Buddha nature. Okay, so what's cool is that when you become enlightened, you will look like the most exquisite thing you can imagine, you see? So the first thing to get over is the idea that the Buddha that you were picturing in your heart had to be oriental, you know? Like, sometimes Christy and me go buy a Vogue magazine, and I try to point out the person I'm going to be like. Which brings us to the second question. Which is what? Yeah, male or female. I mean, doesn't have to be a male at all. I mean, it's a 50-50 chance, right? And I'm not just being politically correct. I don't like politically correct. And usually I'm on the wrong side of politically correct. But on this one, I'm on the right side. I mean, when you get enlightened, you will look like the most beautiful creature you can imagine, male or female, doesn't matter, okay? I mean, there are many women Buddhas, incredible women Buddhas, and the higher you get in your studies as a monk, then the more women Buddhas they tell you about, you know? Like the day you do your final exam after 20 years of study, there's a secret thing they do. It's really, really cool. Like you've been there for 20 years at this monastery, and they take you up to the abbot's room, which is up on top of the main temple, And they take you into this side room, which I had never seen before. And there's a throne there. There's a throne for a high lama there, okay? And they take you in there, and these older monks, you know? And this is after you've finished all the exams, all the courses, everything. And they make you get up on there, which you're never allowed to do. You're never allowed to even touch this throne. They make you get up on it. And then they leave the room for like 2 hours. You know? And they just don't say anything. They say, get up on there. And then they leave, you know? And then you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's supposed to be happening, you know? And I think a lot of monks have told me they get this experience of them as a Buddha, you see? It's very beautiful, you know? Like, they don't tell you anything. And they don't tell you, they don't suggest anything to you. But a lot of people that I talk to said when they sat up there, and you know, for the first 10 minutes you're scared like they're going to come in and brand your head with something or something. And then you figure out no one's going to be there. And you just sit there and then you start seeing yourself as a Buddha, you know. And a lot of people that I talked to saw themselves as a woman Buddha, you see. It was very beautiful. They saw themselves as a very beautiful, like, angel, you know. Like, you always see these pictures of angels and you never really believe it, you know. And a couple of high geshes that I've met said that they had this weird experience that they were a Buddha. And then when I pressed them, they said, yeah, and I was a lady Buddha. I was a woman, you know. And I want to experiment with that. You ready? Let's do another meditation. Okay? So this time, the Buddha is a lady, and it's the most exquisite lady you can imagine, okay? And no problem. We'll talk about it later, but work on that. Like the angels you always saw on the churches. And you can make her whatever race you like. Doesn't matter, right? Doesn't matter. When the Buddha comes to America, Buddha will look like an American, right? So let's work on those two things. The Buddha is only as big as a grain of sand. And this time it's a woman if you like. And any form which you find most exquisite to you. And so we'll have like 100 different Buddhas here. It's okay. Okay, here we go. It's like 5 minutes. Do some reconstruction. Okay, come out. So yeah, 3 more people. There's one lady right here in a blue dress, or with a nice cross. with the cross here? Yeah. Oh, don't make her really shy. This is like Oprah, right? What did he or she look like? Say again? Oh, who is that? Good. That's one, okay? A lady or a man? Good. And you?
Mine was a mermaid.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, sometimes they say go for the first thing that pops in your mind and hold it, you see? Like, don't debate it for half an hour. Whatever's the first weird thing that comes up, just hold it. You know? And how about this lady right here? In the same row. Yeah. Yeah, nice. Once I did this with some people that we did retreat together, and one lady said, I don't know, but she's got black tight jeans on. That's the thing. And like for a week she's telling me, I didn't get the rest, but she's got these tight black jeans on, you know. And I'm like, okay. So now we got three ladies, I think, right? But now I got one more step for you. For each of the three of you, was it somebody else or was it yourself? It was somebody else, right? We got to go back and fix that. Okay? We got to go in and fix that. All right? You ready to start again? We got to start. Get sit up, do that whole shtick again. Okay? And this time, male or female, it's you in your heart. It's an enlightened being. Okay? Totally enlightened being. And it's you this time. Okay? It's the Buddha, and it's you. And whatever he or she looks like to you. Go for the first image. Okay. I'll shut up for a few minutes. Okay. Okay, good, good. So what do Buddhas do? I think when I was growing up and I read about Buddhism, they were always saying that there's this guy, Buddha, came to the world like 2,500 years ago, is always sitting under a tree, meditating all the time. I mean, you always see them sitting down, right? And that just seemed pretty much like what they do, you know. They sort of sit under a tree and they say wise things to people. And that was Buddhism for me, you know. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of Buddhism is quite different. I also grew up as a Christian and I love Christianity. Like I was brought up in a church in Phoenix. And it was a beautiful church and we had wonderful ministers, priests. And I was an altar boy for 10 years. I was in the choir for 12 years. And I really, really liked it, you know. And I really like it. And it was a good thing. And when I started to study with the monks, the Tibetan monks in the monastery, a couple things changed. I mean, a couple things I really liked. One was that you could have your own altar at home. You know, like that was a big change for me. Like before I could only go to church on Sunday. And I had to go to their church, you know. And then the Tibetans were teaching me, oh, you can have your own altar in your own room, you know. And then you could go to church every morning, you know. And then there are like sacraments or different things you can do, but you can do them for yourself. You don't have to go to another building and do them. And then you can do your prayers and you can go to church at home. And I really liked that. Like that was a really good thing for me. And it helped my practice a lot. And then, I think the most difficult thing for me to get over was they kept saying the purpose of being a monk is to become a Buddha, you know? Like, it's not just to wear robes around, or it's not just to meditate, or to be calm, or to be like mystical. They said the real purpose is that you're going to end up being a Buddha. You know, and for me that was a really difficult jump to make, you know, because I grew up in a Christian church and we worshipped Christ. And we believed in that Christ was like came down from God, right? And then there was this Holy Ghost thing and that was the Trinity, that was three things. And it wasn't ever too clear, but the idea sounded really good to me. It felt good to me, you know, like someone wanted to come to this planet to help people. And didn't have to, like was living in a different place that was happy all the time and nobody dies there. And then this guy chose to come down and help people. And I thought that was really beautiful. But then when I got to the monastery, and after a couple of years of study, it was very clear that the whole point was that you become the Jesus. You know? that the goal is that you become the next Jesus, you know? And that seemed a little ego, what do you call it? Napoleonic, what do you call those things? Delusions of grandeur, right? Like I was thinking, it seems a little almost disrespectful to say, or to think that, you know? Like if I had gone into my church when I was 15 years old and said, could I be the next Jesus, you know? And they'd say, this kid's got a problem, you know? Like some kind of ego, what do you call that? Egomania almost, you know? But in the monastery, it was just assumed, you know, like a 13-year-old kid comes into the debate ground and says, let's debate the Buddha I'm going to be. You know, and you're like, what do you mean? You know, he says, I'm going to be a Buddha. I just want to debate what color my hair is going to be, you know? How tall am I going to be, you know? Am I going to have this big nose or not, you know? And it was really hard for me to get over, you know? It was really, really difficult for me. I don't know how it is for you. But the training in the monastery and in Buddhism, the whole point is that you would be the next enlightened being on this planet, you see? You would be the next Jesus on this planet, you know? And not in an egotistical way. It's like, this is a very wonderful goal for each of us to strive for, you know? Like, everybody's complaining about how random God is. And when I was growing up, there was a debate about whether God had died and we didn't know it, you know? And because it just seems so bad. Things like seem random, you know? And then it's funny because once you've studied in a Tibetan monastery, the pressure's on you. Okay, if you could run the show, how would you do? What would you do, you see? Like, if you're going to be the next enlightened being on this planet, well, how would you run the show? You see what I mean? And I don't know about you, but then I suddenly get this thing, well, I'm not sure I'm quite ready yet. You know, like, if you put me in charge of the world, you know, I'm not sure, you know. I don't think it'd be safe, actually, you know. And I just don't think I'd be capable, you know what I mean? Like, it's a big thing to run, you know. You know, what if they said, you keep complaining about God, right? You keep saying, God allows all this injustice in the world. It's not fair. God's not fair. Well, would you be any more, what do you call it, even-handed, you know? Could you be totally fair to everybody? You know, if you were in charge of the show tomorrow, how would we think about you? Would you be running things in a real fair way, you know? Would everybody get fed and would you never get angry at anybody? Would you never feel like jealous of anyone? And could we trust you to be God tomorrow? Frankly, I wouldn't want to be. I still get angry all the time after 30 years of intense training and understanding all the bad karma I make. I still make bad karma every hour of the day, you know? So I would like to say I'm not qualified to be the next Buddha on this planet. But then what's interesting is that in the monastery, then the pressure starts to build on you. You see, the whole training is like, well, then you better get. They wouldn't say, oh, okay, you're exempt. You don't have to be the next Buddha. They would say, well, get your act together, man. Let's start working on it. And they would start. You have to start with a category of your weaknesses. Like you categorize your weaknesses. You make a, what do they call that in AA? What do they call it? Internal inventory. Yeah, an inventory. Yeah, it's like an internal inventory. And you make an inventory. You know, what are my weaknesses? And so okay, anger is number one. Envy is a close second. You know, and then there's desire and all those other things. And then that really puts a fire under your practice, you see? Because you're faced with the possibility that you're going to be the next enlightened being on this planet. So we don't want an incompetent dictator. We want somebody who's going to be totally fair to everybody, somebody who's totally compassionate, someone who won't step on a bug, given the choice. You know what I mean? Someone who walks across the sidewalk and is watching out for bugs. Isn't that what we used to complain about with God? He doesn't look out for the little people. In Tibetan they say, Tabadi, which means horsemen don't look at the ants. Horse riders don't look at the ants. And they Are we going to be like that? Would you be like that? Can we trust you to look at the ants? You know what I mean? So this whole thing about Buddha nature is developing your own Buddha nature inside of you. And the whole process is, frankly, developing your kindness, your ability to be kind. Where does your ability to be kind end? Like, will you be kind to the person next to you here, but not to the person two seats down? If Rebecca gets pulled out of this auditorium tonight and her collarbone's broken in the torture rack, do we call anybody? Do we do anything? Or if it's on the other side of the planet, is that different? You know what I mean? Like, can we trust all of us to be concerned about people that we know are suffering, but we just can't see them? Right? You know, it's not like sitting next to us. If they pull Rebecca out of the... Sorry. Or the auditorium and beat her up outside because she was at a Buddhist meeting, then will we do anything, you see? Because if you're not going to, we're not going to trust you to be the next Buddha, you see? And everybody wants to be the next Buddha. That's my theory, see? There's this thing called Sagatagarbha. Like, everybody wants to be the next Buddha. Like, some of you think you're students. You think you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, or somebody told me a computer expert, or somebody was saying to go into an alternative medicine. But everybody who's a student in this room, you have some kind of vague plan. You know, like, what would I like to be? You know, and there's a lot of things a lot of times it's negative, right? I know what I don't want to be. I know I don't want to be like blah, 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 or blah, blah, blah. But then a little part of your mind is like, yeah, I would like to be, I'd kind of like to be in an office that's kind of a big shot, you know, or maybe I'd like to be a TV producer, or I'd like to be an actor, or rock and roll musician would be all right, famous one. You know, something like that. Like, you have some kind of dim thing that you'd like to be, right? And then as you get older, I think it changes. Like, you try a lot of stuff. You play guitar for 5 years, no one wants to listen to you. You kind of shift, I did. You shift to another thing, you see? And you start to narrow what you would like to be. Like, you say, okay, I'm satisfied if I could make $50,000 a year at anything, even if I don't like it. That's okay, I would do it. If you got this dim plan in your mind, like, that would be okay. Or some people just thinking, you know, I'd sort of like to be respected, you know. I'd like other people to think highly of me. You know what I mean? I don't have to be famous anymore. Okay, I don't have to be Madonna anymore. Or Michelle Branch, I don't know what it is nowadays. I don't have to be on AOL when it pops up. I'll settle for being the biggest shot in my office. Like, if I was the person in my office most respected. And then maybe it gets even narrower. Even if just the three of you in my family would be nice to me. You know, that would be enough for me. Then I'd feel like I had made it in life. So, I mean, everybody... There was a Tibetan lama from Mongolia. And he was one of my lamas when I was young. And his name was Geshe Kalden. And he was old. And he was a refugee from Tibet. And most of them ended up getting TB. He was in the first wave, 1959 wave that came out. And so the Indians used to grab these guys if they were coughing and tie them down to a table and cut out one of their lungs if they thought they had TB. And he was one of those. And he survived. And so he walked like this all the time. And then... we were sitting by the side of the road. He came to New Jersey one time. And we're like at the edge of the New Jersey Turnpike, and it's going whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. 8 lanes each way, you know. And he's like, wow. You know, and then he says, Michael, look at those cars. You know, and I'm like, yeah, cars in New Jersey, like the worst place I could ever imagine to be, you know. And... just don't laugh. I mean, this is the cost of learning, right? You have to go where you most wouldn't want to be. But anyway, I said, yeah, they're all driving. He says, yeah, but everybody's driving somewhere. You know, and I said, Yeah, they're driving somewhere, you know, like no big deal. And he says, because they all want something. And I'm like, okay, they all want something. And he says, and that's why they started the car. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. That's why they started the car. And he says, and that's why they got in the car. And I'm like, okay, they got in the car. And he says, and that's why every goddamn person on this planet gets out of bed in the morning and puts their foot on the floor. They want something. Like, and then I was thinking about my really depressed friends who stay in bed all day. Because, like, people have really bad depression, they just stay in bed all day. Because they don't want to put their foot on the floor. And then I'm thinking, yeah, everybody wants to be something. Like, you put your foot on the floor because you're hoping for something, right? Or else you would stay in bed like those 1 out of 500 people who doesn't get out of bed every morning. They don't even get up for it. And so in the monastery, they say, don't sell yourself short. They say, the purpose of training, the purpose of meditation is to become something bigger, you see? And then they start to train you, like incredible trainings. Like the whole thing about being in a monastery, becoming a monk or a nun, training for year after year, meditating, being trained, is much bigger. It's very, very cool. And then it unfolds and it reveals itself over a period of time. And they are training you to be the next Jesus, you see? And it's unbelievable. Like, at first you're very, like, come on. You know, I just want to learn some books so I can impress people back home. Or, you know, I just want to wear these cool robes. I used to read... it was some Marvel comic, I don't remember, but there was always Tibetan monks in it, and I said, I want to be like them. And then they said, no, that's not the thing. You have to help everybody. You're going to help everybody. Dr. Strange, was it Dr. Strange? Yeah, yeah, it was Dr. Strange, up in the Himalayas. Yeah, and they're reading these books, and they're all shaved in it. Yeah, we got to get some of those. But anyway, so they said, You're being trained for something more, you see. You're being trained to see every living creature in the universe. And then it really appealed to me because I loved science fiction when I was a kid. I loved science fiction. And to think about people on other planets. And they're like, we could teach you to see those people. We could teach you to see those people. And I'm like, wow. And then they teach you. It's unbelievable. It's really cool. Before you can become enlightened, before your Buddha seed nature can be developed, you have to be able to see every living being. And they teach you. They teach you how to do it. And it's unbelievable. It's just like everything... like no one ever got up here and said, I think, at this university, I'm not sure, and said, okay, this course is for seeing every living being in the universe. This is Buddha nature 101. And by the end of the course, you will have an experience in deep meditation where you will meet every living creature in the universe. Bug, amoeba, human, here or on some other constellation, you will see them all directly. You'll meet them all directly. And I'm like, but isn't that going to take a long time to meet all of them? And they're like, no, it happens all at once, you see. It all happens in one moment. You see all of them in one moment. So I'm going to teach you just the beginning of that, okay? We got to get back to meditation. Ready? Okay. And go back to that Buddha, he or she or he, on the rose, okay? Very much concentrate on it in the middle, inside your heart, deep, deep down inside your heart. And she is you. There's a blue spot of light, light blue, sky blue spot of light in her heart, okay? So now you're inside the heart, right? Make a tiny blue pinpoint of light in her heart. Now send a tiny arrow, ray of light to the blue spot in the heart of one other person here. There's a bridge connecting your two hearts now, the two Buddha hearts. It's a tiny sliver of blue light, light blue light. Connect to one other heart. Then I'll snap my fingers and you will connect to every other heart in this room. A light, blue ray of light connecting to every other heart in this room, and hold the connection. Then I'll clap my hands, and in that instant, you're connected to every other living creature in the world. Huge network of lights. I'll clap my hands again. Every living creature in the entire universe, all worlds. Hold it. Hold it. Then bring it all back to the spot in your heart. Okay, nice. Open your eyes. Nice. Really nice. Really nice. Practice that, okay? Practice that. It, one day, it will come. You will see them all directly. You have that capacity because you have Buddha nature. Every living being has the same capacity. Your mind has the power to see every living creature there is directly and to help them directly. And it's what you're really meant to do when you get out of bed in the morning, okay? And it'll take time. I don't know. A couple of weeks, years, maybe lifetimes. But we will meet many times again, and we will practice, and then one day you will see them all directly. And then you will be able to serve them directly. That's a very beautiful. If you have any questions, we'll do some questions and then we'll just go home, right? But if you like, practice that one sometimes, okay? Practice that one sometimes. Anybody have any questions? It doesn't have to be about this. Yeah. We're going to put the mic on you because we have programs like we help prisoners in prisons. And they say, could I get a tape of what you did last weekend? And then they always complain because they can't hear the questions on the tape. So go ahead.
Well, my question is, Buddhism's ubiquitous, huge setback. But he supposedly lived on one MC a day and was, you know, starving himself. So why did they picture him as this big fat guy?
Oh, yeah, okay, good. There's four kinds of food in the ancient scriptures. One is McDonald's. Okay. No, I mean, one is called kamgise. Kamgise means food that you can eat. You see what I mean? And one is called rewa. Rewa means hope. And they say that, I mean, how many horses ever died 2 inches from a water hole? You see? Think about it. How many horses ever died 2 inches from the water hole? You see? So, like, if you get within 50 feet of a water hole, something keeps you going the last 50 feet. Like, if you're in the desert and you're dying of thirst, something gets you, even no matter how bad you are, you could get 2 more inches and drink the water. You know what I mean? So they say hope has the power to keep you going. What's the other one? Sleep. Is it sleep? Yeah. One is sleep. You know, people need sleep. It's like food for people. Like, if you don't sleep for 5 days, you'll know. And then one is concentration. One is meditation. You see? If your meditation gets really good, it's like sustenance. It's like food. And it can replace the function of food. You see? If you get into deep meditation, you don't have to eat much anymore. So actually, people who are really good at meditation, their bodies don't get older much. They can stop that process of getting older. You can learn to meditate in a way that you don't get older, because you're living off a different kind of food. You see? So actually, a person who's doing that practice that you mentioned, like a person who's really good at using meditation for food, they just get stronger and stronger, you know? They look healthier and healthier. And you could be getting older and older, but you feel like $1 million. Like, you could be 50 and feel like you're 16 and rarely get ill, or just like have all this energy and all this power because your concentration is good. And that's what the Buddha is really like. I think the belly thing came from India when they didn't have enough food, and chubby people in India are more attractive. In India, if you are robust, it means you have enough money for food. And so you are considered to be like it's the equivalent of wearing a business suit in the United States. Like, if you've obviously had enough to eat in India, it's a sign of your status. And so oftentimes a Buddha will, when they go to a certain country, they will try to look like whatever's beautiful in that country, you see? So when the Buddha appears in India, it's like, should be big, like a football player or something, you see? So that's why they're painting like that, you know? But actually, a person who's doing good practice, your body gets healthier and healthier, and stronger and stronger, and you're living off of concentration and compassion. Like, if you take care of others, the more you take care of others, then the healthier you get. It's a very beautiful thing. So you just get healthier and healthier. And the older you get, the better you feel. And you feel sort of guilty because all your friends who aren't practicing are like getting older. Anyway, that's another thing. Another question? Yes?
What does this do when you're meditating?
Oh, good.
What does holding your fingers do?
Yeah.
Yeah,
good. She asked about this mudra. It's called chin mudra sometimes. But it's where you connect your thumb and your first finger, like that. And there's different ways. Some Tibetan schools do it like this, in your lap. And some people do it palms down, some do it palms up. But this one is special for, you have your blood system. Like, imagine your veins flowing through your body, you know? Like in a tree trunks, like dividing and going through your body. And then there's like your nerve system, right? In the center of those pipes is like a crystalline, living system made of light. And that's we call prana body or lung body. That's your inner body. And so you have these veins or channels going through your whole body, and they look just like blood vessels or nerve, nerve sheaths, like running through your body. And you can't see them. A yogi, a deep meditator, can see them and feel them. But normal people can't see them. And actually, your blood vessels form around those channels. And your nerves form around those channels. And your skeleton forms around those channels in the womb. Anyway, why am I talking about that? There's two big channels that come down to the end of your thumb and the end of your first finger. So if you connect them very lightly, like as light as possible, as you get stronger, it'll be about a millimeter apart. They won't even be touching. And then it's like a spark plug gap, and the energy is running and jumping across the gap and then continuing, and it creates sort of a feedback, like a meditative feedback, like biofeedback or whatever that is. But the prana, or the energy running in your inner channels, it creates a feedback loop, and it helps your concentration. So like that. And that's true if you do yoga or things like that. There are special postures taught in the advanced Tibetan systems where you do special exercises to have the same effect. Yes, please.
I'm really enjoying the seminar.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been practicing Buddhism since like 1994, and for a lot of years it was the greatest peace of mind that I ever felt. But since 9/11, my whole world's stood on its head now.
Yeah.
And I seem to attract a lot of people who I help want to take more advantage of me.
Yeah.
Want to take everything from me and leave me nothing.
Yeah.
I meet a lot of people that feel that, oh, everybody got killed and the Trade Towers of 9/11 deserved it. Mm-hmm. And I just can't write them off like that. I can't feel like this.
Yeah.
That, oh, it happened to them because they were evil.
Yeah.
And this goes on and on. Look at the trouble that Tibet has with China. China wants to take over Nepal. And they sent an ambassador here, and he wanted small arms for the Nepalese armies. And everybody went, we'll never help them, because there's no oil there. And then 15 months later, we did decide to help them, give them small arms. And people are going, well, that's wrong, too. You know, these people have a right to defend their way of life. Mm-hmm. And I just... And my world's darker, I'm much more volatile. I'm a veteran, the soul journey is gone for 8 years and now it's back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having a lot of trouble with this. I'm having a lot of trouble with people. I'm much more volatile.
Yeah. There's a very beautiful practice. It's very, very powerful. And I suggest you do it, okay? It's called giving and taking. And it's called Tonglen in Tibetan. It's called giving. It's like that. It's a lot like that. But there's a special way to do it using the channels that we talked about. This is like a tantra almost. But when you meditate sometimes and you feel disturbed, like you feel upset about the world, and actually if you want to help the world, okay, there's very powerful seeds you can plant. And it seems kind of funny, you know, I mean, on one level, we should all do political action, and I have my whole life. I went to jail during Vietnam, briefly, okay? A priest came and got me out. But, and social work I've done my whole life. And that's important, too. Like, we feed several thousand Tibetans in the refugee camps.
I've been to Nepal, and I used to watch them come in from Tibet every day and tend them for us.
Yeah.
And it used to break my heart. They'll just days of confused as I was.
Yeah. Then there's a third level you can work on. It's called a karmic level. Like, do political work. Do social work. Help people in trouble around you. But then there's a very much deeper level. There's a third level that we should all work on. And I believe it will help you. So I'll suggest it. You, as you're meditating, then you take people's pain away from them. You know, like someone whose family was hurt, somebody whose husband or father was hurt at the World Trade Center, killed. Then you take away their pain on your breath. So when you breathe in during your meditation, then you imagine that you're taking away their pain. And when it reaches your inside your lungs, You see it destroyed like that, like a flash bulb. Poof. And it goes away. And then when you breathe out again, you give them some kind of happiness. You say, peace. Peace. So you breathe out. Out, you give them peace. In, you take away their grief. And then you're working at a karmic level. Okay? So it's important to work at a political level. And we do. It's important to work at a social level, social work. And that's good. And we do that. But you must work at a karmic level, which means actually changing the seeds for this world. Like, each of us has that power. And that's just through the motivation of wanting to take away their pain. And then it will change the world. You see, it's very beautiful. It's a very powerful practice. The only thing I have, one more thing that I say to you specifically that would help you a lot. When you breathe out of your right nostril. Okay? And it's not like you have a choice, right? It's not like you can, you know, and I'm not saying that. Imagine that it's coming out of your right nostril. And then when you breathe in the pain, bring it into your left nostril. And that has a very soothing effect on your psyche. And it changes your karma. And that changes your world. And so we should do political work, we should do social work, and we're all doing it, right? But that's like working with cement that's half set already. You see? And then when you do this thing with your heart, with your mind, when you do that thing of connecting the lights, you're working on the level of what causes the world. You see? You're working on a much deeper level. So it's not good to just sit there and space out and do that all day while Rebecca's being dragged out of the auditorium. Like, you got to get up off your meditation seat and go help her, right? But at a deeper level, you must work on the meditative level also, because that's what creates the world. So you have to do all three. And that's my suggestion for that. And we were just in New York, you know. We didn't hear about the World Trade Center until June. Last June, when we stepped out of retreat, we heard about the World Trade Center. And a lot of our friends were there, you know. The head of our ACI in New York was caught in an elevator in the building next door for 4 or 5 hours. The former chanting leader was walking in the front door when the plane hit the building and got away. So, you know, we did this in New York. It helped a lot. So work on that. My suggestion. One more question, then we'll quit. How's that? Then if you want to work me more, come on the weekend. Hi.
Something I was thinking about when you were talking was that the mountains are just shifting, and houses were destroyed, people's lives were just shifted, and then they ran. We went up there recently, and you can tell the difference. The new growth is so beautiful, and everything is coming up, and it makes me think about what happened in New York and how people die because all the same strength that comes from that and all that new growth.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you one thing. You know, I was in New York and I'm trying to serve all my old students there, and then one of them says to me, we were having a meeting, and he says, "No, Geshe-la, you don't know the worst thing. It was the smell of 3,000 bodies for weeks and weeks. It's not like you can stop traffic on Houston Street and say." Smell shouldn't come north of Houston Street. They said you could smell the people for weeks. And he started to cry. And then he said, he says, you don't know what happened in New York City was a renaissance. It was like something that never, ever happened in New York was that everyone got compassion. And Christy and I were there. We were trying to cross the street. Every time, we're trying to wait for a guy who was picking us up in a car. Every time we get near the corner, every car stops. Like, they think we want to cross the street. And we're like, this is New York? You know, it was weird. It was on 9/11. It was the second anniversary. Three cars, like, screeched to a halt in front of us. And we're like, no, we're just waiting for somebody, you know. And we're like, this is weird, you know. This is New York City. And people just spontaneously hugging each other all the time now in New York. So there's a lot of beautiful stuff came out of that, and big, like a big compassion came out of that, and all the people in New York were really like a lot of them told me they felt a lot better than they did before, because now everyone appreciates each other and everyone's like loving each other, and I thought that was really, really cool. Anyway, yeah, so I agree. In that sense, it was a good thing. So come if you like. You know, there's a registration thing there, and there's a box, and you can just ignore that. Like, we never charge anything. We always put a box there to try to recover the rental of the hall, and we never make it. But you're just welcome to crash any of those sessions that you want, okay? So it's 12 to 2 and 3 to 5 at the Muse. And just come in and sit down, and you can hang out, and we'll be going through this Buddha nature thing in much, much greater detail. Like, that'll be 4 days of what monks do in a monastery. And it's a little heavy, but I think you'll like it. So please feel very welcome to come. And I'd like to give a hand to Daniel and Michael and Jonathan and all the other guys that sponsored us tonight. Okay, yeah. Okay. We'll see you. Keep doing that meditation.